I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Today we get a reality check on some of the things that we associate with summer. Shark bites, tick bites, and sunscreen. I'm sure like me, you've stood in the sunscreen aisle at the drugstore trying to figure out what the safest SPF is and what to make of all the unpronounceable ingredients. A recent study from Northwestern University Medical School found that consumers were confused and misinformed about sunscreen. Our guest led that study. Rupal Kandu is Associate Professor of Dermatology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure.
Let's begin with the sun protection factor, SPF. And from your study, you found out that many people really didn't know what those letters meant. Let's talk about the numbers. What do the numbers mean?
Sure. In terms of SPF, the American Academy of Dermatology recommends that consumers use an SPF 30. And SPF 30 is able to block 97% of the UVB rays from the sun. An SPF 15, for example, will block 93%, and if you go ahead and bump to an SPF 50, it blocks 98%. So after a point, there's not an additional benefit to increasing your SPF.
So you're saying SPF 30 should be fine for everybody?
SPF 30 is what the American Academy of Dermatology and in my practice what I recommend.
And you said this. No, go ahead.
In terms of protection, again, from UVB, the critical piece is really also having the broad spectrum component, which enables us, the consumer, to know that they're also getting protected from UVA radiation.
And tell us the difference.
So UVA and UVB are the most two common ultraviolet radiations that come from the sun. UVA is not absorbed by the ozone. It can filter through clouds and window glass even. So when you're indoors, you can be receiving UVA radiation. UVA is linked to an increased risk of skin cancer and also early skin aging, so wrinkles and age spots. UVB, on the other hand, is partially absorbed by the ozone. It is most related to sunburns, and we usually think of UVB for burn or sunburn and UVA for aging. And so that's why there's been a reliance on SPF, because many consumers are buying sunscreen to prevent sunburns.
Sometimes sunscreens, or maybe they all are now required, assuming they meet the criteria, with the words broad spectrum. Does that cover both UVA and UVB?
Correct. And that has been the new regulation from the FDA, which is very important for the consumer to know. And the wording, really, in terms of having the words broad spectrum on the front of the label, means that that sunscreen has met FDA guidelines of covering for UVA and B protection.
So what I hear you say, in a nutshell, look for the words broad spectrum and SPF 30, that if you do that, you've probably got yourself covered.
You have the right product, and now it's the use of the product that's very important. So the other critical pieces are the reapplication. So sunscreen only works, one, if you're putting it on and reapplying it and putting on enough. So first, in terms of putting it on, we recommend that you put it on 15 minutes before you go outdoors so it has enough time to absorb, that you reapply it every 2 hours. If you're in the water, that's another labeling criteria. And labels will have the terminology water resistant. So water resistant at either 40 or 80 minutes, where it's been shown that it continues to work with that much in terms of if you're actually going into the beach or going to the pool and reapplying it. And then finally is putting enough on. So in terms of the quantity, we recommend about an ounce, which is equivalent to a shot glass of sunscreen, to cover the exposed areas of a typical person.
And does it matter if it's a spray or a lotion or what type of sunscreen we use?
That's a very interesting point. So these FDA regulations are really based on the creams and lotions, gels, not on the sprays. The FDA is still looking at the safety and effectiveness of sunscreen sprays right now.
What about people if you're just, you're just living your day, you're not going to spend the day at the beach? Should people still put on sunscreen?
So I recommend it in a daily use in terms of an anti-aging protection against UVA is coming through window glass, if you're driving, it's coming through your glass in the car, and we can really minimize aging, but also that still leads to skin cancer as well. So it can be part of your daily routine, and now there's many options in terms of moisturizers that have broad spectrum SPF in them that can be part of the daily morning routine.
You look at some of the ingredients in sunscreen, and you know, I certainly can't pronounce them, and I wouldn't even try on the air. But one wonders, is that okay to rub all that, those chemicals or whatever they are, into our skin?
There hasn't been shown any concern with the current ones that are approved by the FDA that they have regulation over in terms of over-the-counter products. They're actually looking at some additional ones that are used in Europe, for example, and doing their safety tests on that. But currently, they're safe to use and haven't been shown to have any link to other issues in the long run.
What about something like zinc oxide, which I saw as described as quote-unquote natural?
So there are two main types of sunscreens. There's chemical blockers or physical blockers. And in general, the physical blockers are zinc oxide, as you mentioned, and the other main one is titanium dioxide. And those are preferable for those who might have sensitive skin, for children who might not want, a parent might not want to use a chemical blocker on them. And they don't bind to the skin. They just sit on the surface. And the classic is thinking of the lifeguard with a nice white stripe across. Those are the less transparent. Now the formulations are much more elegant where they're nanoparticles, and so they blend very well with the skin.
And do you suggest people, if they're going to be outside, to wear long sleeves? It sounds like so much not fun, but wear long sleeves, wear long pants, wear a hat. I mean, are those things that, for the most part, we should make sure we're doing?
Exactly. So sun protection measures in general include, you know, enjoying being outdoors and enjoying your time, but being what I would quote, say, sun smart. And so it's using your broad spectrum SPF, limiting time during peak sun, which is 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., wearing long sleeve shirts, pants, hats, and sunglasses are also very important for your eyes as well.
When you see pictures of people at the beach wearing their bathing suits at noon, having, you know, enjoying the sun and surf, what do you think?
I hope they have their sunscreen on.
Really? I mean, is that enough? If you have your 30 SPF on, you'll be okay?
If you are reapplying it and using appropriately, there is still some penetration of UV that is coming through. We know that. And there is potential to have some changes. But we really want to get to a point where people are able to buy the types of products that they want, know what coverage they're getting, and again, be able to enjoy being outdoors as safely as possible with minimizing the risk for skin cancer, skin aging, and of course, sunburns.
What about people of color?
The same applies for people of color. There really are the same recommendations are in place. People of color still have skin cancer, all types, non-melanoma and melanoma skin cancer, and it is just as important for people of color to be using broad-spectrum sunscreens.
Are we seeing an increase in skin cancers?
We are. There is over 3.5 million skin cancers diagnosed annually in over 2 million people, and it is an ongoing issue in terms of dermatological care and cancer care in the whole country.
I remember hearing that if you had a really bad sunburn as a younger person, that increased your chances for getting skin cancer when you're older. Is there some truth to that?
So having a blistering sunburn definitely does increase your risk of having skin cancer in the future. Tanning beds are also another high risk factor for developing skin cancer, along with your own personal family genetic history.
So obviously, and I guess people with fairer skin are at greater risk for some of these cancers?
We do see more skin cancers in those with lighter skin, yes.
You had mentioned tanning beds, and there's been some controversy about tanning beds. What would your advice be to people who are thinking about, well, I'd like to go to a tanning bed, maybe before I go to the beach to get my tan?
I do not recommend anyone going to a tanning bed or a tanning salon. You're definitely getting direct to UV exposure. The bulbs are usually heavy with UVA and then some UVB because you do not want to burn. And so they use the UVA technology more. And we know that is an increased risk for all types of skin cancers.
You're the lead, author of this study talking about the fact that people are misinformed, confused about sunscreen. Did that surprise you?
Not based on my clinical practice. It is one of the most common questions we have when people come in for skin cancer screenings is what to use and how to use it. And I will commend the FDA and their new regulations. There's still more work to be done, but it is moving in the positive direction. And these new labeling algorithms are helpful. Now we just have to make sure the consumers can understand what they're trying to relay in terms of knowledge.
And going forward, are you looking for more improvements?
I hope so. There is, again, the investigation on sunscreen sprays that will be helpful. Also itemizing in terms of the SPF and how high of an SPF number can be listed. As we know, the UVB filtering is minimal after an SPF of 50. And also maybe considering how the UVA labeling is given in terms of having it provide a little bit more information of the level of protection of UVA, similar to how we have the level of protection for UVB based on SPF.
And should we think about wrinkles and UVA?
Exactly. It's very true. UVA is directly linked to wrinkling and age spots and what we call photo aging.
Well, Arupa Kundu, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times, telling us a bit about what we should know about sunscreens.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Associate Professor of Dermatology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. We have another guest waiting in the wings, something not to worry about this summer, and that's shark attacks. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Two teenagers were attacked by sharks earlier this year in North Carolina. Both apparently lost their arms. This is a very rare occurrence. Meanwhile, a great white shark named Mary Lee, who has thousands of Twitter followers, was sighted along the East Coast this spring. We wanted to know more about these animals, the many roles they play in the ocean, and what to do if we see one. We asked Marie Levine to join us, founder and executive director of the Shark Research Institute that's in Princeton, New Jersey. She has dived with sharks. And Marie Levine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Maria, I began by talking about a shark attack, but one of the reasons we wanted to have you on the show is to say that we really shouldn't worry about shark attacks. But based on what you know about these two teenagers who were attacked by sharks earlier, I believe this month, what should we know about what happened?
Well, in the first case, the girl was bitten 50 yards from a fishing pier. Now, in a fishing pier, you've got bleeding fish, anglers are throwing chum into the water, and that's what attracted the sharks.
And how about for the boy? Do you know?
He was a little bit further down. He was about 2 miles further down the coast, but... and there was another fishing pier. I'm not certain how close he was to that. But there is shark fishing is allowed all along Oak Island beaches. So, you know, it could have been anybody fishing at night. Sharks remember where they have gotten food, like all animals.
Well, so what I hear you saying is don't swim near a pier where people are fishing. What are other things that people should at least think about? Let's say if they see a shark, and certainly it's possible to have a shark sighting.
Well, actually, every time you go into the ocean, you are swimming with sharks, but we're not on their menu. For us as divers, many of us are divers, I mean, it's so difficult to find a shark these days. So when we see a shark, we are thrilled and just enjoy in the encounter. But if most people, if they see a shark, if they're worried about it, just back away. Just, mm-hmm. you know, move slowly toward shore.
What I hear you saying is that they don't want to eat us.
They absolutely do not. You know, every animal has a menu in its brain. And, like, we eat plants, but we don't sit around an oak tree for dinner. It's very, very specific.
Are sharks staging a comeback?
Not really. Most populations have really plummeted, and that's due to the shark fin trade. There's a bill pending in New Jersey to end the trade. Texas, just this last week, banned the shark fin trade. 10 states so far have done that as well. The U.S. has a Shark Conservation Act, which prohibits finning, but it left a big, big loophole in it. As far as the sale and possession of shark fins. And unfortunately, yes, many species are in very, very deep trouble. Some are really on the brink of extinction.
I was reading that something like, and we're talking about shark fins here. I'm assuming that's for shark fin soup, Marie?
Correct.
I mean, there's that much demand for shark fin soup?
Well, you know, it's apparently there is. Many, many years ago, it was something that was served to emperors in China. But with the growth of the middle class, it became a status symbol to serve shark fin soup at weddings. Now, shark fin soup is actually chicken or pork broth, and the fins add absolutely nothing to it. They don't add any nutrition. They don't add any flavor. It's just a status symbol.
I was reading somewhere that something like a, correct me if I'm wrong here, something like 100 million? No. Could that be 100
yes.
million?
Yes.
Sharks are killed every year?
It was. We're now thinking it's more like 73 million because the shark populations have just plummeted.
Which tells you that
73 million is huge number. And these are animals that reproduce so slowly. A sand tiger shark gives birth to only 2 pups. It's just, you know, they just can't reproduce themselves fast enough to make up for the slaughter that's going on.
So imagine, and this is a horrifying thought, but imagine then an ocean without sharks. What would ocean life be like?
Well, it would probably be the end of fishing because one of the what sharks do is they control the populations. They're the apex predators. So what they do is they weed out the sick and injured of other fish populations so that only the healthy breeders are there. And so you have healthy populations of fish. No, you take out the sharks and you're really messing with the ocean ecology in a very negative manner. In fact, off New Jersey, we had what was called a trophic cascade where so many of our large sharks were taken out that the animals that they preyed upon, which at that time were mostly skates and rays, proliferated. And suddenly you had this population explosion of skates and rays. And they, in turn, fed on our clams and oysters, which are the animals that filtered the water. So, and besides putting so many shellfishermen out of work, it had a profound effect on our water quality.
So kind of like a way of, sort of like a septic tank, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Marie Levine. She's founder and executive director of the Shark Research Institute. It's located in Princeton, New Jersey, and the second of three guests in this hour. We are talking about sharks. She talks about the rarity of shark attacks, but also the role that sharks play in the ocean, the important role that they play in the ocean. Any questions or comments to join the conversation? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In my introduction to you, Marie Levine, I mentioned Mary Lee. This is this great white shark who has been sighted off the East Coast. I don't know if you know where she is today. Do you?
No, I don't. But she was most likely moving up north to Massachusetts, to the Monomoy Island area, because of mature great white feeds on marine mammals such as seals. And she was like 10 miles offshore, so she wasn't anything that, you know, an animal that people would be likely to encounter. Now, New Jersey, back in the 60s, well, and even now, it's a pumping ground for white sharks. And it's where they give birth.
And why is that? I mean, is there something about the environment, the ecosystem there that's good for birthing?
That's what we're trying to find out. And but people, again, don't really need to worry about a newborn white shark. It's not going to, you know, it's not going to. It's number one, it's a fish eater. White shark is when it's small, and it's not going to hurt anyone.
It's interesting that Mary Lee has apparently thousands of Twitter followers. I guess that's a good sign.
Isn't it?
But are we still dealing with the Jaws effect, that we have this kind of visceral, scared reaction to great whites?
Certainly not among young people. Perhaps older people who were affected by that movie, because at that time, when Jaws came out in 75, there wasn't an awful lot known about sharks. One good thing that the movie and the book did was to spur research on these animals. But, you know, as Peter Benchley said, and he was one of our strongest supporters and a member for many years until his death, that book was fiction. People bought it in the fiction department. No white shark has ever really behaved like that. And no white shark had so many teeth either as the one in the movie.
Oh, and I remember that scene of that shark kind of lunging at that boat and that very scary teeth. But interestingly, people took fiction and believed it, I guess, like fact. But what I hear you saying is that that's less and less true today as that movie sort of recedes into the background.
Oh, right. It certainly has. And, you know, most children love sharks and dinosaurs. And then the children growing up nowadays, I think, have a realistic picture of sharks.
What's the kind of, you have swum with sharks. What is that like?
It's wonderful. You actually, I expect to hear music, and I think I do in my head, but it's not Jaws, it's a symphony. These are animals that move with such grace. They're living sculpture. They're just beautiful, beautiful creatures.
And is there a kind of body language that you have learned in swimming with sharks?
Yes. And, you know, just as we know not to pet a dog that's snarling, sharks have a very definite body language, and when you swim with them often enough, you get to recognize it very, very readily. Their whole demeanor changes, and, you know, because if you get too close to their personal space, they let you know.
How do they do that?
Well, it's partly their posture, and they'll often lower their pectoral fins, and It's just as nobody teaches us about dogs' body language, but we seem to know it. And when you're in the water with a shark and it's trying to give you a message, you know it. The problem is, of course, that surfers and swimmers can't often see the body language. And like a swimmer might be crossing a channel now, a shark can't swim backwards. And so if a swimmer suddenly confronts it, that shark gets frightened.
And is that why it might react the way it does?
Yes. Yeah.
Out of fear?
Very often. There's nothing malevolent about sharks. They're just other animals trying to get by and trying to survive, and we're not on their menu. I've been diving with sharks for 40 years, and I've never felt threatened by one.
Wow. We have a caller that says more people are killed by deer, car collisions, than sharks. You would probably agree with that, Marie Levine.
Absolutely. Absolutely right on target there.
So if, besides, I guess, putting a stop to shark fin soup, what can be done to help bring back the shark population?
Well, I think more protection for them. Now, next year, there will be a meeting in Johannesburg, South Africa, CITES. CITES is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Flora and Fauna. And we have been sending our scientists there since 2002. And we have won protection for the whale shark, basking shark, white shark, and five other species of sharks in 2013. And the more that these animals can be recognized as renewable natural resources, the wealth of a country, the more protection that can be afforded them.
And how hard is it, or how easy is it, to police some of these agreements?
Well, sometimes that's very difficult because there really is nothing, you know, out on the open sea. It's like the Wild West. And that's where a lot of the damage occurs.
How many species of shark are there?
We usually say about 340, but that's flexible because, you know, they're finding more and more subspecies of various species. So, but roughly 340. And from small deep water sharks that could fit in your hand up to the whale shark, the largest fish in the sea.
And is there a number that you and others are going for to say, you know, this would be the right number of sharks to have in our oceans?
No, there really isn't. I think everybody kind of bases their judgment on how healthy the sea is, how healthy the fish populations are.
How did you become interested in sharks?
I think because I started out as a nautical archaeologist, but when Jaws came out, you know, I thought it was a wonderful, good action movie, nothing more. And I think we can take a little lie, but we can't take a lie. And what was being said about sharks was a big lie. And bit by bit, I got into sharks.
And based on some of the things I've read about you, it sounds like you swim with sharks really all over the world. Is there a favorite spot for you?
For different species, different areas.
Such as?
Whale sharks off KwaZulu-Natal, tiger sharks in the Bahamas. It depends on where the problem is, finding the animals. White sharks, South Africa, and Guadalupe Island off the west coast, off Mexico.
And you're saying the difficulty is finding them because there just are not enough of them, or are they?
That's correct. That's absolutely true, yes.
So what do you look for to try to find them?
Based on, you know, we do have researchers all over the world, and in South Africa, Australia, Tasmania, all throughout the coasts of the United States, Mexico. And it's based on what their findings are and what fishermen are telling them. And, you know, I suppose, yeah.
Word of mouth in a kind of way.
Very much so, yes.
And I'm curious about what you wear when you're swimming with sharks.
I don't wear a chainmail suit.
Well, that was one of the reasons I wanted to ask you, because I was reading that sometimes these high contrast suits are kind of loud colors that can attract sharks.
I've read that, and there are suits being manufactured, I think, in Australia that they think sharks won't see them as well if they're wearing them because of the patterns. I just wear a black wetsuit.
And are you in a cage, or are you actually swimming along with these sharks? I guess depending on what kind of species we're talking or what.
Well, the only species that are used to cage for are white sharks, and that's only until I get to know the population and the individuals in a group. I don't use a cage with any other species.
So once you get to know them, you feel like you know their, what, personalities or just sort of
They're just as different, you know, even with white sharks, they're as different as dogs. There was one white shark when I was working off South Africa. I would stay in a cage when that, she was a big female with an attitude. But then there were others. There was a young male white shark who was just as gentle a soul as you could find.
Well, on that note, Marie Levine, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Founder and executive director of the Shark Research Institute in Princeton, New Jersey. And waiting in the wings, we have Thomas Mather. We'll be talking about ticks in the summer. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. A cold and snowy winter can mean a proliferation of ticks when the weather gets warmer. And since people and their pets like to enjoy the outdoors in the spring and summer, it's smart to be vigilant and knowledgeable about ticks. Joining us is Thomas Mather, known as the Tick Guy. He's director of the University of Rhode Island Center for Vector-Borne Disease and its Tick Encounter Resource Center. And Thomas Mather, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, it's really nice to be here. Thank you.
And you don't mind being known as the Tick Guy?
You know, somebody has to do it.
I guess so. So is this a good season for ticks? And by that, I mean a bad one?
Well, so it seems like it is. People are finding more ticks in more places probably than ever before. Deer ticks, dog ticks, lone star ticks, wood ticks, brown dog ticks. They seem to be just everywhere.
And is that because of the kind of winters, at least we've been having here on the East Coast?
Well, so, you know, the harsh winter, you know, at first, you know, everyone was saying, well, one good thing about all this snow, at least it'll kill the ticks in the spring. Mm. Well, that turned out not to be true. And we need to remember that for future years, by the way. But it's not really about that. I think that the key to this more ticks in more places phenomenon that we seem to be experiencing in the last several years is really the growth of the reproductive hosts of the ticks.
And by that, I guess you mean us or our dogs?
I mean white-tailed deer.
Okay.
White-tailed deer are probably more abundant now than even when the first white settlers came to the United States. And it wasn't always that way. You know, in the end of the 1800s, you could pretty much count the number of deer in any given state on a couple people's hands. And now there's just thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And a good number of the ticks that we are experiencing, black-legged ticks, sometimes people call them deer ticks, Lone Star ticks, Western black-legged ticks, Gulf Coast ticks, all of these types of ticks in their adult stage prefer over all other hosts white-tailed deer to steal their blood meal from. And so as we have more white-tailed deer, it's not hard to understand why there's more ticks, too, because there's just more opportunities for those ticks to steal a blood meal. And, you know, once they do that, they lay thousands and thousands of eggs.
Well, they're certainly common here in the Philadelphia region. What do you suggest people do? Let's say they want to take a lovely walk in the woods, and we have beautiful parks here. What do you suggest people do?
Yeah, well, so we just need to, as we call it, get tick smart. This is a campaign that we would like people to pay attention to, you know, five core practices that they can build into their lifestyle. Certainly knowing what types of ticks are where you live will help, knowing when they're active. I mean, not all of the stages look the same. Some are tiny, some are larger. Some start lower on the ground and climb up from your shoes. Some grab onto your pant leg. And all of the, knowing all of these things and the seasons that they're there would help people better protect themselves, and also would help them know better where to look after they've gone out and enjoyed their nice walk.
Well, I'm assuming what you're saying is wear long pants, perhaps even tuck those pants into your shoes or your sneakers, wear a long shirt. Am I on the right track here?
Well, so, you know, years ago I was being interviewed by, I think, a reporter from the Lancaster, PA area, and we were talking about something, and then at the end he said, well, I suppose you you agree with everybody else that says exactly what you just said, tuck your pants into your socks and wear long pants and et cetera. And I said, well, you know what, that no one really does that, so I don't really agree with that. You know, let's give people things that they can do and that they will do. And so we did a study with tick repellent clothes. This is clothing treated with permethrin, and we treated summer weight clothes. And in that study, we found that overall there was about a 5 times less likelihood of a tick bite when people wore even summer weight clothes, just crew socks, sneakers, shorts, and a T-shirt, as long as it was treated with permethrin repellent.
So it sounds like you're saying is either do that to our clothing or perhaps to our skin as well, and that will reduce the chance of a tick landing on us?
Well, so you can do it to your skin, but the repellents against the repellents that people use on their skin don't really work as efficiently against ticks as they might against mosquitoes. And so the most effective way to repel ticks, and it actually kills them in the end, is to wear the permethrin in your clothing.
Oh, interesting. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's a Thomas Mather, director of the University of Rhode Island Center for Vector-Borne Disease and its Tick Encounter Resource Center. We are talking about what we should know about ticks this summer. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's say we find a tick on our body or perhaps on we'll put the dogs in a separate category. Let's say we find a tick on our body. What should we do?
So back in the day, as my son likes to say, people flushed them down the toilet or they burned them or they hit them with a hammer or dispensed with them some other way. Well, if you do that these days with all of these types of ticks, how are you going to know what type it is? How are you going to know what risk you face? Because each type of tick is associated with different disease pathogens. And so our new paradigm is that people need to save that tick, put it in a Ziploc bag. It won't get out of the Ziploc bag. And then find a resource, a credible resource, on how to identify it. And our Tick Encounter Resource Center website, I think, is a fine place to turn. We have a program on Tick Encounter called Tick Spotters, and we will, if people take a picture that we can recognize, we'll get back to you with a personalized message, usually within a day, telling you what type of tick you've experienced, how risky it might be, and what you should do next.
Oh, that is quite a service, I have to say. And do you suggest using tweezers? Is that the best way to remove a tick?
Well, so there are, you know, dozens of tick removal devices. Certainly it's never been a good idea to burn a tick off. And as these ticks are the size of poppy seeds sometimes, attached places that you can't even see below your belt, it doesn't make sense to try and touch them with a hot object, right? Because that's kind of dangerous. But you can try all of these methods that are out there, Dawn dish detergent, cotton swabs. They seem, these must work, and you'll be still playing with them for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, trying to get the tick off. A simple pointy tweezer grabbing something the size of a poppy seed close as close as you can to the skin and pulling it straight out, and you're holding on to it at the same time. So a lot of these little scoopy devices, people will report, well, I used this little scoopy device and the tick fell on the floor and I couldn't find it. So, you know, why people want to reinvent the wheel, I'm not really sure. But the simplest thing is to grab it with a tweezer, pull it out, put it in a bag, and then your next step is to work on identifying it.
Should we also be concerned about ticks in our backyard? Let's say we don't have white-tailed deer in our backyard, but should we think about the possibility that there might be ticks there?
Well, so a lot of people do encounter ticks in their own backyard, or at least in their own neighborhood. And many people know that they have deer nearby. Just because you have deer nearby doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have ticks. We hear that all of the time. Oh, I have deer, and so I have ticks. It might be that way, but the ticks don't always follow exactly that same pattern. But let's just say that you do have deer, at least nearby, that you know in your suburban neighborhood that they kind of run through every once in a while. Then it's very likely that there is some level of, let's say, in your area, probably both black-legged deer ticks or Lone Star ticks, certainly American dog ticks, and those are all options, you know, that you could encounter now in your backyard. And so one great strategy, the diseases that people get from ticks really spill over from wildlife. Most of them are actually in small rodents and birds, and ticks, immature ticks, feeding on those small rodents and birds, pick them up, and the pathogens spill over to whatever the next thing is, the tick's bite, which might be you. And so if you have fewer ticks, you can imagine there's going to be less spillover. And so because the mice themselves aren't going to transmit those infections to you, it's the ticks that had fed on the mice and then feed on you that do it. So a great strategy is to reduce the number of ticks, even in your own area, so that there's just a lower rate of spillover from wildlife to you.
Speaking of dogs, do dogs, and are they particularly attractive to ticks?
Well, so dogs are out in the habitat, so to speak, a little bit more than people usually. And so they do acquire ticks more commonly. In a study that was done years ago in Massachusetts, you know, if the rate of Lyme disease in people was somewhere around 15 or 20%, it was about 80% in dogs. So they do get encounter ticks a little bit more frequently. There's great ways to protect dogs. In fact, there's more ways to protect dogs than there are people, to be honest. So, but people have to do it.
Well, and yeah, they're topical things, and then there are little, I guess, pills and things that dogs can take as well. What is the purpose of a tick? Why do they exist?
Well, so, you know, years and eons ago, they adapted to be tick-like, I guess, and they just were very successful, and, you know, evolution goes to the winners, and they seem to have figured out how to win.
And they live on blood. I mean, they are bloodsuckers, so that's sort of vampires in a way, I guess, and that's how they've been able to survive.
That's all they do. So it's really when you sort of start digging down a little bit deeper into what a tick is all about, they're quite fascinating. I mean, most people see them as, you know, all one thing, but they're multiple types of things. And each type of thing, they have their own adaptations and special ways of sort of making their living. Mostly, they make their living from stealing blood. And they have a lot of different strategies. And a lot of those strategies are built into their salivary glands. So in order to steal blood, I mean, most organisms with blood, you know, they've developed fine ways to not lose their blood because, of course, we want to hold on to our blood, and ticks want to steal it. So they've been in this constant battle evolutionarily over, you know, millions of years, you know, sophisticated blood loss prevention strategies by mammals and sophisticated blood stealing strategies by ticks. And so their salivary glands are chock full of pharmacologically active molecules for deadening pain, for keeping blood from clotting, from, you know, basically avoiding inflammation until after the fact, and et cetera, et cetera. It's actually quite fantastic.
Well, now I know why you're known as the tick guy. are we in kind of prime season now? It's the very beginning of summer. Things are heating up. Is this the time we should be most vigilant?
Well, it turns out May is the tickiest month, so we actually are on the back side of the worst of it for this year. The only thing about June, July, and July in particular is that more people are outside then, right. So there may be a little bit more exposure. But and since we've been doing the Tick Spotters program, which is a national crowdsourced program, May has probably had double the rate of submissions than any other month.
And are ticks more common on the East Coast, or are they pretty much distributed around the country?
Yeah, there are probably on the eastern United States, there's a slightly greater variety of ticks that will attack people and pets, and their numbers seem to be higher than in other places. But, someone in Montana can get into a bundle of wood ticks, and they would debate with you who has more ticks.
Mm. And what is the most common tick?
Well, so the most commonly reported ticks through our Tick Spotters program are black-legged ticks. However, it shifts with the season. So even though right now there still are probably a lot of black-legged ticks out there, they're in their nymphal stage, which is that poppy seed size stage, so people mm-hmm. don't find them as frequently. They're probably there. They're probably getting bitten. But people don't find them. Right now, the most commonly reported tick is the American dog tick.
Well, on that note, Thomas Mather, thanks for talking to us about ticks.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Director of the University of Rhode Island's Center for Vector-Borne Disease and its Tick Encounter Resource Center, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, what to be concerned about this summer and what not to be concerned about. I'm Marty Moscowain. Send us an email. Tell us what you think about Radio Times. You can also download a podcast of the show. Check it out, Radio Times at whyy.org. And do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.